This is an Enterprise Times podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here with James Strachan, Senior Architect at CloudBees.
Hi. Hello. Welcome, everyone. I joined CloudBees the end of last year. My focus is really how to optimize the CI/CD experience, and Jenkins in particular, for Kubernetes. Kubernetes is a fairly new thing. It only started maybe 4 years ago. We're at KubeCon right now, and it's a huge conference, and there's so much excitement in the industry. It reminds me a little bit of the Java 1 days, like a decade ago, when everything was exciting and new, and talking to people on the floor, like, everyone's excited about Kubernetes. New things are happening all the time. We heard of gVisor 2 days ago. Like, all this new stuff's happening. Everyone's really excited. People at Google are talking to Microsoft and Heptio and CloudBees. There's this huge collaboration between companies because we're all trying to put open source technologies together to deliver value for our customers and take advantage of the cloud and so forth. It's such an exciting time right now. I'm having heaps of fun. The main reason I joined CloudBees is there's a really exciting opportunity right now that Kubernetes kind of changes everything about how we build software, test it, deploy it, release it, promote it. The whole idea of DevOps on Kubernetes, everything has changed now with Kubernetes. Deployment used to be a really hard piece of CI/CD because deployment was anything. Every customer would do everything completely differently. You know, one customer would have Perl scripts that someone wrote a decade ago. Someone else would use Bash. Someone else would have written some custom piece of software to deploy software. People don't even agree on Zips or Tarball. It was random. There's four different. Some people use Salt. Some people use Ansible. Some people use Chef. Some people use Puppet. There's just all this tooling and technology, and it was all different. Now with Kubernetes, we can have one single canonical way of packaging an app, a Helm chart. Then we can deploy that on any Kubernetes cluster. That cluster could be an IBM cloud, Oracle cloud, Amazon cloud, Google cloud, Azure. It can be on-premise, it can be OpenShift, it can be anything, DigitalOcean. Pretty much any cloud vendor can now take standard deployments and just roll things out. The main reason I'm super excited is we can now automate everything in CI and CD. Now, for a long time, we've been able to automate CI. To be fair, CI is the simplistic side of the spectrum. You're running a Docker build or something and running some tests. That's good, but it's not awesome. What we want to do is automate deployment. We move a piece of software. Version 1.2 goes from testing to staging to production. What that means increasingly is varied. You know, some people have 20 production clusters in different availability zones across the world. But we can automate all of that, right? We can completely automate the entire DevOps pipeline from CI to CD. Using the cloud, we can do all kinds of really nice things. For example, in Jenkins X, we can do things like preview environments. So whenever you make a code change, we can package up that code change before it's merged, before you've committed to going ahead with that code change. We can take that experiment, we can build it, package it as a Docker image, deploy it in a Kubernetes namespace by itself, isolated, and then people can click on it and try it out in a pull request and review a running app in a pull request before people decide to merge. If this is a UI, you might go, that buy button is way too big or way too small. So the UX people can be reviewing it. CSS Ninja can be looking and think, oh, I think you could do a different CSS thing. Some people just go, "That I hate that color blue." Whatever, like, you can visually try things out. You could run custom tests, manual tests, automated tests. It gives you a way of testing things and using the cloud for what it's good for, being elastic and automating everything. To be honest, I've never been so excited in the IT industry ever, because right now we can automate almost everything about the software delivery pipeline. As soon as you start automating things, you realize how much stuff is just manual grunge work that isn't really delivering any value to your customers. You're manually updating things, you're manually deploying things, you're manually making tarballs and SCPing them around or whatever. Now we can automate almost everything in the CI/CD pipeline, which is really exciting.
But it's part of the reason we're doing manual, because we haven't fully understood how to automate. We have people out there when they build a pipeline who don't understand every decision in that pipeline has to be a binary decision. Because only when it's binary can you effectively automate, effectively roll back. And more importantly, you've decomposed to a point of trust. It's simple. It's easy. You can see your markers. Irrespective of the other technologies, how do we get them to that point of decomposing to a trusted, simple set of pipelines?
There's a few different things in there. Let me go back a little bit and then I'll get back to where you just were. We started an open source project called Jenkins X, which is trying to make Jenkins more cloud native. It's almost like trying to reimagine Jenkins, using Jenkins, but reimagine Jenkins as if it was designed for Kubernetes to begin with. Jenkins was built like 12 years ago, before there was even containers. Jenkins is a hugely successful, well-used project, but we're trying to make it more and more cloud native and feel like a native appliance rather than a single master running in a JVM. We're trying to make it like a cloud service and cloud native. One of the things we're doing with Jenkins X, though, is we're trying to automate the creation of the pipelines. As soon as you move to containers and as soon as you move to Kubernetes, everything is kind of different, and most developers don't know how to build the right Dockerfile, how to package the Docker image as Helm charts, how to deploy those into different environments. What we're trying to do with Jenkins X is different for the Jenkins ecosystem. It's a different kind of story. We're saying you can do any pipeline you wish, and you can curate those pipelines and whatever, but at the same time, we're trying to say, why don't we just automate those pipelines for you? Why don't we just give you what we think is the best pipelines? And when there are decision points, like, should we accept this code change? Should we promote this version to production? Whenever there's a decision point, we prefer a tool that is good for collaboration. So rather than the current approach in Jenkins, where there's a yes-no button in a build blog, which is okay, it's not awesome, we prefer to use pull requests or issues in the issue tracker so you can have a conversation. There can be information and links about, I'm upgrading the cheese application from version 1 to 2. Here's a link to all the issues that are fixed in this release. Can somebody approve this release, please? And then the pipeline waits for that approval before it goes to the next stage.
But is there not a danger here that we end up, as we have at the moment, with too many approvals in that line? The struggle for people is, how much do I automate? How fast do I automate? When do I need somebody to make a decision for me? And if you're going to have those decision points, they have to assume an awful lot of older approaches are cleaned up. Otherwise, we lose all the velocity.
Yes. No, I think that's an excellent question. What we're trying to do is automate the pipelines to start with, and we're trying to pick what's a good first guess at what we think people should start with. So what we do today with Jenkins X out of the box is every team gets their own development environment where the developer tools run and Jenkins and whatnot. Then every team gets a staging environment and a production environment. And we set the staging environment to automatically promote. So whenever I merge to master in any app, it automatically promotes to staging. But we've left production as a manual choice. So you can choose, I've ran this for a day in staging, I'm happy now, I'm going to choose when I think it's ready. But we kind of want people to go on this journey where we want people to automate more of that stuff, because we want it to go straight to production, really. But I think different teams are going to have different confidences in this. The more you automate, I think the more you get happy with automation. And I think we want people to choose to automate all of it. But another thing we found that was interesting is the more human approvals you have in a pipeline, the more delays you get. And one of the things we want with CI/CD is we want to get people doing tiny changes and going to production as quick as possible, because you get the quickest feedback. And we want that feedback loop, because the more feedback, the quicker we can go and the faster we can deliver value. If you have human approval steps all the way, you have 3 approval steps before production, that could take 2 weeks to get to production. What we've found with doing things like preview environments, we can try and push more of the approval back before you merge, so that as soon as you agree that the code change is going into the master branch, that should just go straight out to production. It's deemed ready already to go out. So what we're trying to do is get more human approval at the experimentation stage when we're doing pull requests. Once you hit merge, we really want that to go straight to production if you can. But that does depend on the team. I think different teams will have different levels of confidence. And I think different people get confidence in different ways. Like, some teams might want to do promotion to production, but for, say, beta testers only, or only employees for a day or whatever. So it's a soft launch. It's still automated, and you have a window of, say, I don't know, a day, where if you're not happy with it, you can roll back. But if nobody complains, it then goes out automatically a day later or whatever.
How much does Kubernetes change the size of the object we're pushing? If we think today, we're still thinking about pushing an application or a major set of code. The reality of Kubernetes is it segues really nicely into the original conversations about objects. There's no reason why each container couldn't contain a simple function. That function can be versioned, managed, pushed forward in a far better way than having to consistently build, which is what we do with software today. The containers can link together. We hand to a container. After all, we're using the same kernel. It's not as if we're trying to do this across multiple kernels. That would, first of all, make it easy to look at a function and approve it. It would reduce some of the concern over the size. It should speed up the velocity of what we deliver. We can fix an individual tiny piece without a massive set of build processes. Are we realistically looking at that from a CI/CD perspective, or is that out there somewhere?
I think there's a spectrum. There's different things going on. Serverless is like the extreme end, where you literally are deploying a function and that's it. It's a single JavaScript function. On the other end is the monolith, this massive, gargantuan, huge pile of code that is so huge and complicated that changing anything in it has risk, because no one understands what it does. it's really hard to change anything because I could have broken anything and I have no idea. Nobody understands it. So on one end, you've got the monoliths that are so scary to even work on because nobody really understands it. Then there's this microservice thing in the middle where we're trying to break things down into bounded context, which could be a function. It could be a bit bigger than the function. It might be like a small REST API or something. So it could be a few REST endpoints. There's like this spectrum of function is like the smallest possible unit you could deploy. And then the microservice could be maybe slightly bigger. It might be a bunch of Go code. It might be, you know, 20 functions or something and a couple of libraries. The theme is very strong. The smaller the deployment, the easier it is to understand and the less risk there is with changing it. If you've just got a function, that's very easy to test and know. I've changed the function. I've run my test against it. It's just a function. What's the worst that could happen? Let's just go live. Whereas on the other spectrum, a monolith, you're like, I could have broken anything. I have no clue. And you find that the bigger the monolith, the slower releases are because it might take you 3 months to validate a change. With a function, you should be able to go quicker. I think there very much is this move to objects or serverless. Microservice people often talk about bounded context, which is very similar to functions and objects. It's like here's a small conceptual thing that's easy to reason about, easy to read, learn. And once you see what it does, you should be able to just refactor the whole thing. So long as you can put the old inputs in and get the same outputs out, you know you're pretty good. We're all moving in that direction. I think there is this split between containers and functions, or containers and serverless, which is a fairly arbitrary thing. Some people make a big deal out of it, but containers are a great way to deliver a piece of software because you never really just deliver a function. You've got which version of Node is it, which package.json is pulling in your dependencies. It's never really just a text file. It's always with a little bit of runtime. Now, that runtime could be simple, but a container image is probably the thing that you really should be delivering. It might be your serverless framework hides all that stuff, which is totally fine. But I love serverless, and I love Lambda, and I love all these cloud functions things. And I think it's the future for many, many things. I think just make lots of simple pieces of code that are deployed independently. That's awesome. But I do think we have this spectrum right now between the containers and microservices world and the functions, because sometimes it's easier just to write a little REST service with four endpoints, and it's one thing, and you deliver it together. You have a get, put, post, delete or something, and you keep them together because they make sense. Sometimes splitting those into separate functions actually makes your life more complicated because you could have the get could have different fields to the post or something. Sometimes microservices feel better. There's also the issue with functions is you have to think very clearly about warm-up times and how long should my function need to warm up so that you don't get a cold request. Sometimes you do really want containers, but in many ways it's an implementation detail. We're all moving in the same direction that things should feel like it's serverless. We shouldn't have to worry about managing servers or Kubernetes or clusters or any of this thing. It should just kind of work. Whether a container is used to deliver your software or not might be internal, it might be real. It doesn't really matter that much, but yes.
And that takes us to another world here, doesn't it? One of the functions of a show is to show us the art of the possible. And what we get is we get customer X has turned up and completely destroyed things. We heard this morning Home Depot has moved from 6 weeks to 15 minutes in terms of their cycles. And it sounds all lovely and all very exciting. But the reality is that for every one of those, there are 10,000, 100,000, a million people who are nowhere near that stage. Who is actually driving the CI/CD at the moment? Are vendors doing the driving, or are customers fully engaged in doing that themselves?
That's a really good question. Jez and Nicola have a book out called Accelerate, which is an awesome book. I highly recommend it. They've been doing lots of research into high-performing teams. Nicola in particular is a great scientist. He's been doing really good surveys to get real scientific evidence of what makes a high-performing team and what's the difference. The results are kind of shocking. You have these teams that really are every 15 minutes and they're going at a blazing speed. And then you have these other teams that are a couple of times a year. Even if it seems like the slow-performing teams are getting slower with time and the high-performing teams are getting faster. It doesn't even seem to matter how many employees are in the company. Higher-performing teams are figuring out how to go better and better because we're automating more, we're improving, and we're continuously improving how we build things, how we do pipelines, how much feedback can we get. I think if you're really trying to improve, we all should be trying to improve all the time, whatever we're doing. If you have a mindset of growth and improvement, you do get better. You just watch, get feedback, figure out what you can do that could improve, whatever it is you do. We're being driven by lots of people like Jez and Nicola and various other authors who are championing researching and visioning and describing what are the things that high-performing teams do. For example, it's been scientifically proven now that feature branches are not a high-performing team thing. Trunk-based development, as it's often called, or merging to master quickly, is one of the traits of high-performing teams, mainly because the longer you have feature branches around for, you've got all this merge hell work, and you have all this stuff about you're racing to get your change in first because you're not the person who has the merge hell to deal with. So it's like there's lots of these things now which we should accept as scientific fact. I think we're increasingly starting to get more of a scientific knowledge of what makes a high-performing team. So high-performing teams use continuous delivery, they do lots of small changes and get those as quick as they can into production. It's been proven in a lot of these researches, the smaller the changes that go out, the less risk, because you know the three things you changed. And if it doesn't work, you've only just changed it, so you know what you changed, so you can revert it and go quickly forwards. It seems counterintuitive, but the more you do something that's painful, like releasing, the more you do it, the better you get at it. So when something goes wrong, you fix it quicker, and you find bugs before they hit production. The people who are doing a release every 15 minutes, usually they have better quality software, they've got less bugs, they have a shorter mean time to recovery, like when there's a defect, how long does it take to get the fix in production? With the Ubers of this world and the Airbnbs, I really think the software industry has been kind of terrible for a long time. There's been lots of disastrous IT projects that spent hundreds of millions of dollars and never actually delivered any business value. I think now we really have to up our game as software developers, and we have to become high-performing teams. If you're not aiming to be a high-performing team, I think it's almost like your business will not exist soon. And there will be a high-performing team in your business segment who will start to eat away your corporate revenue.
If we look around, we see mobile held up as that perfect example of high-performing teams. When we look inside who writes software, the enterprise teams write multiple times more software than ISVs collectively do. There's a risk issue. An ISV writes a piece of software, gives it to you as a customer, and you know, if it crashes or it trashes your business, they're not liable because their end user license agreement puts the fault on you, something which the EU and others are now looking to try and make a change to. But if you're an enterprise developer and that software crashes, that's your job on the line. Worse, with legislation coming in around GDPR, if your piece of software exposes customer data or allows a hacker in, there's a business threatening risk here. So the whole issue of velocity becomes much more of a concern to organizations.
Or you could take down production and lose your company millions.
How do we then take that benefit of mobile? How do we switch the culture inside enterprise? And how in doing that do we get them to understand they can rephrase risk by going for those smaller changes, those changes they can then fully understand, rather than we go back to the monolithic piece of code moment?
The high-performing teams approaches and the approaches of microservices is the only real way of doing this. The only way we can go fast is moving away from monoliths and massive teams writing a huge complex piece of software that never quite works and takes so long to release it, never ever has any kind of velocity, to lots of simple small bits of code that you release independently. And then each release is a small change. So I think it's doing lots of small changes and getting them out fast, and also changing your team structure. Don't have a big, massive team working on a big, massive single release. Have lots of little teams doing independent releases. There's lots of things in there, like we need automation, we need pipelines, we need CI/CD, we need feedback, we need automation, we need management and operations. We need to know when a release goes bad in production with automation and metrics and Prometheus and alerts. There's a lot of things in here that we need to be high-performing teams, but I think the basic concept of working in a microservices way so lots of independent teams are working on an independent piece of software, releasing independently. As soon as you have a monolith, you have to all agree when you're going to release. And the bigger the team, the more excuses there are to not release. And you find, well, I need 6 weeks of testing before my piece, and then I'm just about to go on vacation, so maybe we could do it at Christmas. And before you know it, you're doing a release every year. That might seem like, well, that's a good way of handling the risk, but also that means you're delivering no real value to your customers, and if anything goes wrong, you're kind of screwed. By going fast, it might appear you're being reckless, you're quickly moving code to production, but actually by going fast, you're delivering higher quality code and can react to bad code quicker. It's like anything, the more you do anything that's painful, it becomes easier and better, and you build stronger muscles or whatever to deal with the strains and risk and problems. For example, you might do a bad release, and then you learn, you get feedback. What did we do wrong? Can we do a test for that thing that went wrong? An operator typed a wrong, I don't know, string in some config file when we did a release. Well, can we avoid the manual coding that made that mistake? When you get a mistake, do a deep dive and a retrospective of what happened. Have a blameless, what could we do? It was a human error. You manually did a thing. Well, let's remove the manual step. I think automation is another big thing. A lot of releases, there's a ton of manual stuff, which is all error prone. The more we can automate, the less can go wrong. Just going back to Kubernetes very briefly. This is a small trivial detail in Kubernetes that we often kind of forget, but it's truly amazing. Most of the issues I've found in software, when you're delivering some software, you have a staging environment and a test environment and a production environment, and often they're created by hand by different people. They have different software on them, different operating systems, different app servers, different message brokers and databases. They're all completely different. And then often they're manually configured. And often a lot of your problems are not the code, it's the configuration of the code, or it's the environment has changed, or there's some kind of thing that it's not the code. As geeks, we often stare at this code obsessively and can spot issues in the code. And it's often these soft things that are not the code, it's the mishmash of operational configuration and environment details and versions and whatever mismatches. And it's often the permutation of things that cause a problem, not one piece. With Kubernetes, we can literally take the exact same Docker image and the exact same YAML file that deploys an app, and we can run that in any Kubernetes cluster and in any namespace, and we don't have to change anything. So we don't have to go in and change all these dollar squigglies or environment variables or weird magic strings. For example, if you write a web app and you're talking to a database, you can talk to the database by a fixed string called DB. DB could be your host name. You don't have to have this search replace magic that does templating, that guesses, am I in production? I use this string in production. I use this string in testing. I use this string. And having all this templating rubbish that nobody ever quite tests properly, Kubernetes lets you just do really simple DNS, looking up services by name. Namespaces and clusters make sure you only see the production database in the production environment. You only see the testing environment. So many problems are caused by you accidentally had the production database in the test cluster and you deleted stuff. Automation is a big key. Microservices is a big key. Doing lots of small changes is a big key. But I also think Kubernetes itself gets rid of a huge amount of issues. For me, one of the biggest things that the Googles and the Amazons and the Microsofts have made to IT is they've figured out, how do you actually scale building software? They've figured out operationally, how does one person manage a couple of 100,000 machines? When you look at the old operation teams in like corporate IT, you maybe have 10 people looking after 5 laptops. Well, okay, it's maybe not quite that bad, but you know what I mean. Google and Microsoft and Amazon, they've added a couple of zeros in how many machines people can manage, and they just automate all of that infrastructure, and they focus, rather than operations folks like having to tail logs to see if things are running, they automate the operation of the software. So another thing Kubernetes does, by the way, is it's got something called a liveness check. So every process is pinged by Kubernetes to go, are you alive? Are you alive? Are you alive? You can write really sophisticated liveness checks, like if you're using, say, Spring Boot. You can do liveness checks that says, my database connection pool is fine, my message broker is fine, my cache is not too full, I can write to the disk, everything's good there, the networking is all looking good. If anything fails, your liveness check fails, Kubernetes restarts your pod, your container. If that doesn't come back up, it will try another machine. Maybe it's just this machine. This machine can't talk on the network anymore or whatever. Maybe it's this zone, and then it will fail over and fail over. In the old days, people would do that rubbish. People would be tailing logs and looking at things by hand. The cloud and Kubernetes has automated all of that. Increasingly, we're seeing just more and more automation everywhere, and I think that reduces risk, reduces human error. The more we automate everything, the simpler it all gets.
One of the challenges we have, though, here is, first of all, we have a lot of domain knowledge as to what goes on. As we automate things, one of the things we often lose is that domain knowledge. And we find ourselves 2 years, 3 years down the line with people, when the automation fails or they need to change it, having no real understanding of what goes on. We see the same in teams. One of the struggles with Agile has been we've ended up with very expert teams in organizations who get Agile, and then other teams who are bumbling their way through Agile and really not getting there. And organizations are scared to split those high-performing teams up and spread the knowledge more evenly across. You have to be careful, because it becomes quite an arrogance in a high-performing team versus low-performing teams. How do we ensure that, first of all, we don't lose domain experience as we automate, but also how do we better share the lessons, the knowledge, the capabilities to bring everybody up, not just create one or two DevOps gods inside an organization?
No, I think that's an excellent question. I think there's a few different pieces to that question. Firstly, sharing knowledge. Increasingly, we're focusing on DevOps as using a new phrase called GitOps that the Weaveworks folks have come up with, and we've adopted that with Jenkins X. I think a lot of people have been doing that anyways. They've been using Git for storing all their operational data. When we do releases and we promote applications in Jenkins X, everything's in Git, which means anybody can watch what's happening. Everything's in the public forum, whether it's on chat or whether it's in Git. We can see what people are doing. I'm a long-term open source person, and one of the lovely things that the open source communities have figured out is we can all see what we're all doing, and we can learn from each other by watching them. a lot of traditional corporate IT, we kind of sit in our little booth and we put our heads down and kind of type on the keyboard. Using social tools like issue trackers, GitHub and Git repositories like that, and using Slack bots and all those kind of things, we're more socializing what's actually happening between different teams. The more people realize software development is really a social activity between humans and computers, the more we can use social tools to learn from each other and see what's going on. There's also capturing metrics and operational metrics, so you can see, oh, there's a high-performing team over here. If you want to get better, you can just look at the metrics of that team and see, how are they managing to do 100 releases a day? Like, what are they actually doing? Oh my God, they've just automated it. Maybe I could use the same, or they're using this thing, Jenkins X. Oh, maybe I'll use Jenkins X. Maybe I can get the same level. But I think you also need education. It's quite hard for people just to know you should do this. Open source developers, they learn this, maybe the hard way. The first time I got into open source, I learned more about software development in the first month of doing open source than I had in years before, because suddenly I was like, I can see all these other people working and I wonder why they did that. Oh, I like that. I've never seen that kind of test before. I can see what he did there. Oh, I like his commit comments. I like the way he's, and all of that kind of stuff that you can learn from other people. If you're a large organization, we need a role in large organizations that goes, right, our role is going to be, how can we take the learnings from that team over there to this other team, but without breaking up good teams? For example, you might say, could one of those people work with this other team for a little bit? Can you do it in a nice way? Maybe with like performance bonuses or something. So you get a bonus if you help another team, performance metrics or something. I think there's ways of gamifying it so that we can encourage learning between teams. To be honest, most of this, we should be able to just train people to work in this way. Use microservices, use Jenkins X, obviously. Use Jenkins X, do automated CI/CD, use pull requests, use GitOps. A lot of these things are fairly straightforward to do, but I think a lot of people don't know about them. There's a training thing, but I'm sure there's lots of consultancies, like a Jez and Nicholas consultancy can help people do better GitOps practices. So I think that's another option. Get consultants in that go, we know how to do CI/CD well. Work with the high-performing teams, figure out what it is they're doing. Sometimes in companies, it's often easier to have somebody outside tell you what's good or bad, because then it feels impartial, and then it's a bit easier than one team telling another team what they should be doing. So sometimes having that impartial report that, oh, the high-performing team is doing this and this and this, maybe you should be doing microservices and going quickly and doing small code changes, and maybe we should be going functions and so forth. It's a learning thing. We can all get better. Okay? We can all do more automation.
We're 4 months away now from Jenkins World. What can we expect to see when we all turn up?
Jenkins X is 4 months old. If you look at Jenkins X right now, it's pretty awesome. Imagine twice as much awesome in 4 months in Jenkins X. I'm stunned, quite frankly, in how much awesome is already in Jenkins X. If you want to do CI and CD on Kubernetes, it's a magical thing. Completely automates all of it. We can do lots more. Just rolling out some stuff with Anchor for doing security vulnerability checks and so forth. I think we'll do a much better job doing automated testing, load testing, soak testing. I think we'd do a much better job at joining the operational monitoring in with your pipeline, so we can do things like defining a quality gate. If my new version of an app has more core dumps than it did before, roll back. Or if it gets worse by whatever is important to me, if lots of bugs are raised in an issue tracker, roll back. And then we'll reevaluate and go forwards again when we're happy that it's not got worse. Getting those integrations in so there's more operational metrics and alerts in there. We've got the CVE stuff coming, which is nice. More Git providers. Right now we support GitHub and GitHub Enterprise. We've got provisional support for the other ones, but we want to make that rock solid. The biggest thing that we've had loads of feedback this week that's been brilliant. The lovely questions you get when people look at Jenkins X and go, yeah, that looks awesome. If I was using that on my project, what about this and this and this? And it's where people start to visualize what would their life look like for when things like databases, how do database schema migrations work? How do I deal with 20 production clusters? One of the biggest things I think we need to do with Jenkins X is we kind of need like a pattern catalog that says, you've got a database app, do it like this. This is how we think you should do database migrations. Or here's two choices. You either put your database migration inside one of your apps. Helm has a thing called post-install hooks. So you can say, as soon as you've installed your app, or before you install your app, run this database migration job, then install the new version. So you can tie it into your app, but sometimes the database is shared between three microservices. So if that's the case, the other pattern is have a separate Helm chart for the database migration. And roll out the database migration first, and then roll out the new apps and so forth. And there's lots of different patterns like this. So we use something called Helm from Microsoft. Okay, we use lots of open source. We use Jenkins, obviously, but we use something called Helm from Microsoft, which is a package manager for Kubernetes. And we use something called Scaffold from Google, which does packaging of Docker images on Kubernetes. So Helm is a wonderful thing, and I'm a huge fan. But one of the things it does is it does composition of apps. You might compose microservices A, B, and C together into a bigger composition, which is now just a single versioned artifact. So rather than having to remember which version of A and B and C go together, you can compose them in a separate app. So you can gradually build bigger and bigger compositions of services, and then they become just a single thing you release. You can soon get into version hell. If you've got 500 microservices, it's like, well, which version of what goes with which and what? And sometimes these things need to be quite tightly coupled together because they're very brittle. They're very dependent on each other's APIs or payloads or whatever. There's all these different patterns that are emerging of how operations and development can use Helm to package up operational tools, compose microservices together into bigger subsystems so they're easier to version and test together. For example, if A or B or C changes, re-release a D and use a preview environment and do a regression test of all of the production traffic for a week and check that permutation of A, B and C is good or bad. Again, more automation. I think the biggest thing we need for Jenkins X really is more examples and quick starts to show people, here's how you could use a custom Jenkins image, or here's how you could use database migrations, or here's how to consume the service catalog for Microsoft or Google or Amazon services inside your Helm charts. The core technology is all pretty solid in there, but there's lots we can do on the developer UX. Like, I want more IDE plugins and more awesome developer experience. But I think for me, the biggest thing is some really good meaty quick start examples that show more realistic examples of what you probably are really going to do in production. Right now, our quick starts are a little bit Hello World-ish. I want a couple of database apps or something that have migrations in them and those kind of things, so we can show real tricky problems people are already trying to deal with. We're all making this stuff by hand right now. I think by using Kubernetes and Helm together, we can really solve a lot of this stuff elegantly with GitOps. So we can do everything through Git. Everything's managed in the same way. Everything's audited. We see who changed what when. If any change goes bad, we just revert it. Like, it's really simple. Using that one technique, we can deal with operations, and we can be an operator in a traditional sense. We can be a developer in a traditional sense, and we can do this hybrid world where we're being a bit more SRE-ish and combining the develop and the ops way. For example, we can encourage operators to start building their own apps, which are just their configuration and composition of commercial and upstream open source tools. For example, anybody using Kubernetes should be using something like Prometheus to do operational monitoring and management and alerts. But different teams might want to tweak Prometheus in different ways. One team might say, I'm going to use Stackdriver from Google for all of my stuff. Great. So figure out a single Helm chart with all of your operational stuff and put that in every environment. And then you have a single versioned, repeatable thing which everyone can share. Rather than everybody manually doing that stuff by hand in each cluster, share it. Use sharing and use Jenkins X to automate the releasing of it. For me, the pattern catalog is the thing I really want that helps people go, here's my problem. How should that translate into Kubernetes and Helm and Jenkins X and Git, basically? Because I think we have a really elegant solution now for pretty much any CI/CD use case that people have talked to us about. The tricky bit is explaining it and getting that information out so we can all learn how to do it and then get feedback that if anybody can figure out a better way of doing this, we can continuously improve.
I look forward to being overwhelmed by awesomeness when we get to Jenkins World. James, thank you.
Thank you very much.